Welcome, listeners, to time for an awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your host, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage. That's timeforanawakening.com, and listen to the live stream there. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and listen to the live stream from that location. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your carry-around devices, your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And you can download TuneIn, and in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. You'll see the icon, and you can listen to the program there. You can stream it live, even into your car. That's Time for Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. It's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In their Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily. And before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for Awakening Media is out there and has been launched. That's the homepage. That's the website. You can go to timeforanawakening.com. Just type in timeforanawakening.com and it'll take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. There you'll see more interesting content, also blogs, podcasts of the programs that you can download, listen at later times, or even share with your friends. So again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's Time for an Awakening. Timeforawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, special guest on our program on Time for an Awakening. This is the first time he's here, and I hope it's not the last. Associate Professor of Journalism at Temple University, Professor Lynn Washington, will be joining us this evening. We'll deal with a myriad of subjects. We're going to focus in on the FOP's attack on the black community here in Philadelphia behind the Justice for David Jones movement. Also, the lack of voice from black elected officials here in the city. We'll deal with a lot of those issues with our special guest, Professor Lynn Washington. We'll be right back to get things started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started this evening with our program, I'd like to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
How you doing? I'm doing fine. I'm looking forward to the night's dialogue and discussion, and it seems that it's once again timely.
Well, I'm glad that we have Professor Lynn Washington with us. I've always admired his work, seen him at several times at the Freedom and Reconstruction League meetings. This is the first time he's been with us on Time for Awakening to share his knowledge on several different subjects. Tonight we're going to be talking about the FOP's attack on the black community here in Philadelphia, and the lack of response, unified voice response from black elected officials in reference to the attack. But before we go to Professor Washington and bring him into this conversation, I'd like to play a clip. Marilyn Mosby down in Baltimore after the her decision not to refile charges against the police officers that killed Freddie Gray, and also the community's response, little interference in the background there, also the community's response also to her decision. Listen to what she states and listen to the community's feelings in reference to the police. That'll kind of set the tone for our conversation tonight with Professor Lynn Washington. Let me get this together here and cue this up.
No matter how much we may disagree with his rulings, we do not believe that Freddie Gray killed himself. We stand by the medical examiner's determination that Freddie Gray's death was a homicide. However, after much thought and prayer, it has become clear to me that without being able to work with an independent investigatory agency from the very start, without having a say in the election of whether our cases proceed in front of a judge or a jury, without communal oversight of policing in this community, without real substantive reforms to the current criminal justice system, we could try this case 100 times and cases just like it, and we would still end up with the same result. Accordingly, I have decided not to proceed on the cases against Officer Garrett, Sergeant Alicia White, or to relitigate the case against William Porter. As a mother, the decision not to proceed on these trials, on the remaining trials, is agonizing. However, as a chief prosecutor elected by the citizens of Baltimore, I must consider the dismal likelihood of conviction at this point, the judicial economy in proceeding further, and the divisive impact that continuing this prosecution could potentially have on our community. What I've ultimately learned throughout this arduous process is that although no small task, justice is always worth the price paid for its pursuit. You see, in spite of the fact that the verdicts didn't go in our favor, there have been many gains throughout this journey to ensure that what happened to Freddie Gray never happens to another person that comes into contact with police, justifiably or unjustifiably again.
Our leaders that are in offices and in high places, they are afraid to speak up. This is why I commend the young state's attorney, Mosby, because she's tired of it. You know what I mean? She's a mother, she's a parent. It ain't about, it's not personal with her. It's about, like she said this morning, about justice. And justice wasn't done in that case, and we know it.
My heart was saddened because you can get picked up for a small charge and have your spine ripped out your back, and nobody knows how it happened. So when the police comes around now, we don't know if they're going to shoot us. We don't know what's going on. It's like savage now.
I think it is becoming normal, and it's sad. It's sad because I got a child, and I don't have to bring my son up in this environment knowing that the police could do stuff and then get away with it.
It's really kind of like a slap in the face. It means, you know, sort of like it doesn't matter what, you know, the police officers do, you know. As long as they're all together and they're all, you know, united, then, you know, we have no voice, we have no say. And, you know, they can just take a life, like it doesn't matter.
They rushed to judgment and paid his mother and feel as though that was enough. But you can never, there's no price on death. There's no price when you kill someone. You know, and that was an out-and-out murder. And if it was done to anybody else, a wife or anybody else, they would have been the full extent of justice done to them. But when it comes to us as black males in America, we don't never get no justice. It ain't just with him.
Everything is okay. Everything. You can do anything. The police can do anything to us, and it's okay. Well, who do we go to? Can we go to us? Can we go to them? We can't go to anyone.
Welcome back to Time for Awakening. Let me welcome in our special guest for the conversation this evening, Associate Professor of Journalism at Temple University, Professor Lynn Washington. Professor Washington, are you there?
I'm here. How are you, sir?
I'm glad to have you with us on Time for an Awakening.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Professor Washington, I just played a clip
of
Marilyn Mosby's explanation of her not pursuing charges again against the police officers that killed Freddie Gray. And it was also, in the same clip, community's responses to her and their feelings in reference to the police. What happened in Baltimore is not in a fishbowl. This happens all over the country. And the community's responses or feelings is the same all over this country. We just had an incident here with David Jones being shot in the back and killed by an officer that loves to shoot black people in the back. He did it before and paralyzed a man. Let's talk about some of this, because it goes into a lot of different directions. It goes to the community and the feelings of the black community living in a police state. It goes into black elected officials and their responsibilities to the communities that elect them. It goes in a lot of different directions. But first, before we go there, talk about your feelings hearing the comments from Marilyn Mosby and also the community's responses in Baltimore, Professor Washington.
Well, when I hear these types of comments, both from the prosecutor there, Ms. Mosby, and the community, it just always brings me back to the fact that police brutality, particularly police brutality directed against the African-American community, is a scourge, an illegal act of long standing. In the 50s anymore. They were shooting and killing black people. They were beating them to death, and nothing at all would happen. Unfortunately, in just about every major city around the country, what you heard, both from the community and from the prosecutor, well, you probably wouldn't hear from the prosecutor because prosecutors are part of the problem. But, I mean, the dynamic that they're talking about is the same. What the prosecutor was saying, in essence, is this, that the system is stacked in the favor of a police officer. A police officer is presumed not to do anything. Or should I say, the prosecutor has to prove that a police officer has done something wrong, where if it's just a regular citizen, an African-American of whatever class, you know, they could be a doctor, they are presumed to have done something wrong. And this is what the problem is. And as we go forward, I can get into, like, the legal dynamics of it. But, you know, I hear this all over the place. And let me just do this like as a point, like as a counterpoint, because this, I think, will get into a lot of the areas that you're talking about in terms of systemic problems in the justice system, the lack of consistent responsiveness from our leaders, and also, you know, let's be real, from the community too. In 1951, a group of African Americans, of progressive whites, tried to present a petition to the United Nations charging the United States government with committing genocide against African Americans. They were called Negroes at the time, and they, the people who were behind this, W.E.B. Du Bois, William Patterson, Paul Robeson, Mary Church Terrell, George Crockett, who at the time was a lawyer, he subsequently was a judge in Detroit for a number of years, and then he became a congressman. They were using a provision in the United Nations Charter that says that, you know, genocide is illegal. And one of the things that they put in there is that one of the most flagrant forms of genocide or practices that perpetuate the genocide is police brutality. And there's a line in there that sticks in my mind, and I will never forget it. It said, once the classic method of lynching was the rope, today it's the policeman's bullet. And in the preface to this petition that was sent to the United Nations, they listed 8 what they called recent cases. And of those 8 recent cases of fatal police brutality, 2 of them were from Philadelphia. So of 8 nationwide, they found 2 in Philadelphia. I'm not sure, because I'm moving, so all my books are all over the place. I'm not sure if there was something there in Baltimore, but there's the other incidents that they cite. Baltimore is in there.
Richard.
Yeah, you know, and thank you, Professor Washington, for being part of this and raising that historical piece, because it kind of ties into one of the questions that I had. Of course, recently, I see that in 2015, that the UN, based off of the shooting in Baltimore, they were raising in that United Nations Human Rights Council meeting, right, the question about United States practice in relationship to police brutality and racism. The question I had was, and you kind of said it when they're opening, and it, because I look at our responsibility also. So the question I have, were you aware of whether there was any African-American organizations that were independent observers at that meeting? And has there been one since where that kind of vocal voice by so many nations in relationship to United States practice has been raised at the United Nations?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the fact that the United Nations took a look at police brutality in the United States and also have been taking looks at racism in the United States and been coming out with some very harsh findings in terms of the reality of that we live. I mean, it's not like something, oh, wow, we just discovered this in the United Nations report. We live this. Yeah. But the fact that they even have these reports is a result of black organizations who go to the United Nations and push that body, because we're not getting any responsiveness here. And I'm not sure if it was the 2015 report or one of the subsequent ones, But one of the authors, well, not the authors, but one of the chairperson of the committee that came out with the finding, I think one of the most recent ones, which is probably like maybe 2 years ago now, but the chairperson of that commission was the daughter of Franz Fanon. Mireille Mendez Fanon France. She's a very well-known and renowned activist, human rights activist, not only on the issues of race, but also on the issues of, say, Palestinian rights and others. So the United Nations has been on this, and, you know, you're getting ready to talk about the lack of responsiveness from black elected officials. The black president of the United States, all right, the first African-American to serve in that office, and I'm not talking about somebody who was born in Kenya, that's racist nonsense that helped put Trump in the White House, but he pulled the United States out of the United Nations Commission on Human Rights, and you know, the body that does these reviews on police brutality and racism. He didn't want him didn't want the United States to participate in it. Now, he was listening to Hillary Clinton and other people who said that we shouldn't participate in it, and their excuse was that they felt that this United Nations body was biased against Israel. Well, what does Israel have to do with the fact that our people are being shot and killed in the street like dogs? I mean, they put this dude, this football player, Michael Vick, they put him in jail because he was involved in brutality to dogs. But how many cops have gone to jail? And here we have the president, the people who, you know, folks kiss the ground that he walks on, pulled us out just like Bush pulled us out. And one of the reasons is because they didn't want to have to face up to the reality of what's happening to us, and they were also fearful that these sorts of findings would give credibility to the argument that African Americans deserve reparations.
Which is another big legal issue we have to deal with. You know, I was reading a report that you sent us, and one of the questions, and it still ties to what the Attorney General raised, was the question about the barriers. And I wanted to see if you can elaborate, especially as we look locally in Philadelphia, because that report named Philadelphia and other major cities where this type of abuse has been taking place by police officers. What are the barriers in relationship to the legal barriers and then the administrative barriers, if you could?
Okay. Well, just a quick primer. In the law, it says that to commit a criminal act, you must have what they call mens rea, a guilty mind. You must intend to commit the crime. And see, this creates a big hurdle when it comes to police because they say, well, they didn't intend to kill anybody. They were just out doing their job, and all of a sudden here comes this Negro acting wrong. Of course, he was coming from church, and he's a graduate of a divinity school, but he was doing wrong. And, oh, God, the police officer's gun just happened to go off. I mean, it's like it just jumped up in his hand, and he didn't know nothing about it, and it went off. This notion of having a guilty mind, this is what prosecutors have to prove in exacting detail for a judge to say, or for even a jury to say, the police officer did something wrong. Now, normally, a Negro just walking down the street, coming from church, if he is accused of doing a crime, then they are the ones that have to, they're presumed guilty, and they have to prove themselves innocent versus innocent until proven guilty. So how many instances do we have in this? Well, we saw in May 13, 1985, where the Philadelphia Police Department dropped a bomb on an occupied house in West Philadelphia and conscientiously allowed the fire to burn.
Mm-hmm.
In an effort to flush the people out that were inside. The people who came out were shot at by police and went back inside. And when the grand jury did their report on this, and please remind me to explain to you what grand juries are and how the administrative process is polluted there. But the grand jury said, well, we can't hold any police officer for any charges, even police officers who committed perjury, because no one intended to do anything wrong. Well, if you're making a bomb and the police commissioner says, spike that bomb with C4 so we can get these MFers, does that not show intent? And the other thing, too, is that there's some crimes that don't require intent that just require result. Two of those crimes, one is called reckless endangerment. When you do something and it is so reckless that it endangers other people, and the other one is called risking a catastrophe. Again, if you do something that is so outrageous that it causes a catastrophe, then you're guilty of it. It doesn't matter that you didn't intend that the fire that you allowed to burn would burn down 61 homes, leaving 250 black people homeless, and killing 11 people, five of whom were children. It doesn't matter if you had an intent to do that. Your action was reckless. It risked a catastrophe, and it caused a catastrophe. Would a grand jury, under the direction of prosecutors in the Philadelphia DA's office, say that there was no problem there? And in that report, it's a real big report, over 200 pages, and it said, they found that some of the police officers, particularly the police officers who made the bomb, committed perjury during this investigation. And they said, well, it would be unfair to end this massive investigation with charges against two lowly police officers when, in fact, the city officials were morally responsible for this. Well, if you committed a crime, doggone it, then you should be held accountable for it. But that's what always happens with police. 1978, summer of 78, two black Muslims are up on Allegheny Avenue in North Philadelphia. There was a fight at a bar. They had on their FOI uniforms. They go and stop the fight. They stop the fight. Police officers come up, see the guys, the Muslims. The Muslims had to be been the ones that's fighting, like they were fighting themselves. And so, argument happens, and, they start trying to beat up the Muslims. And then a police officer named Peter Agansky rides up, jumps out of his car, runs over to one of the Muslims and shoots him in the stomach, a guy named Winston Hood, kills him right on the spot. Well, did Peter Agansky be held for account for the murder of Winston Hood? Absolutely not. And furthermore, he was allowed to retire with a full disability pension because he said that he was unable to work anymore as a police officer because people were criticizing him for killing a black man. And if the dude's still living, we're still, as taxpayers of Philadelphia, paying for this guy's pension. And and this is not, again, as you were saying, a fishbowl isolated incident. This happens year after year after year after year, decade after decade after decade.
Professor Washington, let me, because I said before, this subject kind of goes into a lot of different areas. Let me go back a little bit to the FOP's response to activists such as Asa Khalif and some others that have been pushing for justice for David Jones. The statement about rabid dogs, reference to Asa Khalif, and I reference that to the black community, making a statement about rabid dogs. The non-response in a unified voice of black elected officials to respond to that is not puzzling, because I want you to talk about that. But before I get to them, let me read just a brief paragraph from this article here, dated January 31st of this year, in reference to police departments, and then we'll kind of spin that into these FOPs.
Okay.
January 31st, the FBI has quietly investigated white supremacist infiltration of law enforcement. White supremacists and other domestic extremists maintain an active presence in U.S. police departments and other law enforcement agencies. A striking reference to that conclusion. A striking reference to that conclusion and policy prescriptions that accompany it appears in classified FBI counterterrorism policy guide.
Hi, Jagger.
From April, I'm sorry.
Big boy.
I'm sorry. from April 2015, obtained by The Intercept. The guide, which details the process by which the FBI enters individuals on a terrorist watch list, the known or the unknown supremacist terrorist file, notes that domestic terrorism investigations focus on militia, extremists, white supremacist extremists, and sovereign citizens extremists, often have identified active links to law enforcement officers, and explain in detail how bureau policies have been crafted to take this infiltration into account. Although these white extremists have posed a growing threat for years, federal investigators have been reluctant to publicly address the threat or to point out the movement's long-standing strategy of infiltrating law enforcement community. No centralized recruitment process or set of national standards exists for the 18,000 law enforcement agencies in the United States, many of which have deep historical connections to racist ideologies. As a result, state and local police, as well as sheriff's departments, present ample opportunities for white supremacists and other right-wing extremists looking to expand their power base. I read that article in reference to the FOP here in Philadelphia. They've had a track record. If you look back at the dome lights, the thing that was going on with dome lights, if you look back at racist statements that have been made by the FOP president before, and law enforcement that have protected them. Lynn Abraham making racist statements about black men committing crimes, along with Frank Rizzo, who was a former police commissioner and mayor, constantly making racist and bigoted statements. Talk about these FOPs around this country and what they do as a first line of defense. Now, I'm not even talking about the prosecutors and DAs, but I look at them as the first line of defense for these officers once they do stuff, whether it's beat, shoot, or maim black people in these communities.
Wow.
I know it was kind of lengthy, but take care.
Yeah, let me see how I can unpack this. The report that you were referencing about the FBI's examination, the FBI has known this. They've known about this infiltration since at least the late 60s, further back. But even the back in those days, the FBI was actually colluding with these people. They
okay.
still might be, but now they're writing reports about it.
Mm-hmm.
So this infiltration is nothing new. The danger posed by these far right-wing extremist groups is dire. It is domestic terrorism. In the current administration in Washington, D.C., the Orange Menace and his little the little guy who he has as his attorney general, Jeff Sessions.
Leave our Beauregard alone now. Leave Beauregard alone.
Named after a couple of Confederate people. There's a Beauregard and there's a Jefferson, but that's a whole nother argument. But they've said that we don't need to investigate white extremist groups. And they've actually deactivated the Justice Department's monitoring of these groups. Now, to your question about the FOP and its endemic racism, the current FOP president, John McNesby, is now made yet another racist statement and taken yet another racist position. Him individually as well as his organization institutionally. Let's remember, last fall, who did the FOP locally and nationally back? Donald Trump, a person who was very clear in his racism, very clear in his bigotry, and very clear in his desire to see more aggressive policing, which means beating more Negroes in the head, okay? They supported Donald Trump. Now, let's roll this back to 1968. The president of the national FOP was a guy named John Harrington. And John Harrington was also the president of the Philadelphia FOP. And who did they back for president in 1968? They backed a guy named George Wallace. Yes, that George Wallace, the former governor of Alabama, segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. I will stand in the doorway of a college to not let the place be integrated. Federal marshals, you're going to have to push me out of the way. And this is what happened, okay? This is what this organization backed. And it was 2 years later, in 1970, that John Harrington came out with this ridiculous statement that, oh, I just realized that George Wallace was a racist. I didn't know that then. The man was running for the presidency of the United States on a white supremacist platform. So how did you not know that he was a racist? So this organization, the Philadelphia FOP, as well as the national FOP, has a clear line, unbroken chain of racism. And what we saw, or what we heard recently from that little, you know, white power rally up at the FOP headquarters up in the Northeast, and not only did McNesby call Black Lives Matters protesters rabid animals, he also said that they were a terroristic group. And this is dangerous, mm-hmm. because if they start, you know, mouthing off that they're a terrorist group, then they become, you know, under somebody's watch list, and then the feds start kicking in, and Homeland Security and all that stuff starts coming involved. But let's step back for a minute. McNesby calls Black Lives Matter a terroristic group, but the terrorism has always come from the Philadelphia Police Department. So if you don't have police brutality, which is a form of terrorism, then you don't have anti-police brutality organizations. This is simple, right? I mean, you know, this is elementary school kids can see this. Unfortunately, there's a lot of adults in City Hall that don't understand this, but this is what's going on here. So this organization has a history of it. I've been a reporter in this city full-time since the fall of 1975. And I just, you know, checked this out a few days ago because, you know, my mind's going a little bonkers as I get older. So I said, I just want to make sure that I know the dates and times. When the FOP headquarters was down on Spring Garden Street, which it was till about 2 or 3 years ago when they moved up to the Northeast where most of them live, there was an incident that took place in 77 and in 76 where Black policemen, who were members of the FOP, were going to the basement bar. They had a bar down in the basement. And not only were they being punched out and niggerized and all this other stuff, but their wives were being attacked and smacked by white police officers, punks, hitting a woman. That's nothing but punk business. And there was a group of members of the Guardian Civic League who held a demonstration out in front of the FOP's headquarters in 1977. This was like New Year's Eve in 19... Don't let me give you false information. I got this here in front of me. Where is it? 1993, New Year's Eve, going into 1994. A Philadelphia prosecutor, listen to this, a Philadelphia prosecutor, a Hispanic guy named Victor Ventura, for whatever reason, I guess he thought he was one of the boys, he goes to that bar on New Year's Eve, one of his friends, a guy named Eric Batty, and it's not like I remember all this. I looked all this up. I remember Victor Ventura because I'll never forget that either.
Okay.
He goes there. They get, first of all, they thought that they were black rigged, and he said, no, we're Hispanic. Then it was spit this and, you know, bean eater that and all that. I mean, they're Puerto Rican. I mean, they don't eat beans like the Mexicans. That's the majority of them from Mexicans, beaners. They get beat up. Victor Ventura gets beaten badly. Eric Battery gets beaten so bad he has to go to the hospital and he lost sight in one eye. There was an internal affairs investigation done, and the internal affairs investigation was critical of the police department because the police department refused to go in and immediately interview witnesses and everything. So they weren't able to actually bring charges, and there was a line in the report from internal affairs that said that there is a pattern of sloppy investigations of racist incidents at the FOP headquarters, which allows the perpetrators to get off. Now, if this wasn't bad enough, as I said, Ventura was a member of the Philadelphia District Attorney attorney's office. And the head of the district attorney's office at the time was running for re-election. This is a person named Lynn Abraham. So Ventura says, listen, I want these people prosecuted. And they say, well, listen, don't do that, man, because you're going to mess up Lynn Abraham's efforts to get reelected. She needs the FOP support. He said, I was beaten. Doesn't that mean anything? He said, well, listen, we can't do anything because it'll be a conflict of interest. You need to take it to the state attorney general's office. And it went nowhere. The dude filed a lawsuit, and it was thrown out on some, you know, legal mumbo jumbo. But here we have the FOP not only beating up non-white police officers and their wives, but beating up non-white prosecutors and getting away with it. Absolutely getting away with it. And again, nobody says anything about it. It's sickening. It's disgusting. It's despicable.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to continue the conversation with the Associate Professor of Journalism at Temple University. Professor Lynn Washington is with us. Professor Washington also has a law degree from Yale University, so when he talks on these legal issues, he knows what he's talking about. And you can join the conversation, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We got a couple callers on the line. I want you to stay with us, and we'll be right back.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
What is in 1 million brothers and sisters who are tired of the same old rhetoric, the same old leaders, the same old ways of dealing with political and economic empowerment? If you realize that nobody's going to save black people but us, if you understand that no existing political party prioritizes the best interests of African Americans as a collective, if you believe that leadership is as leadership does, and this means that the best leaders for the black collective must come from the ranks of those who place and hold the best interests of black people foremost and uttermost, if you understand that black people must develop the mindset and the will to finance their own racial uplift organizational efforts, then get involved with 1 million conscious black voters and contributors. The movement is now. Go to www.iamoneofthemillion.com. That's www.iamoneofthemillion.com.
The controlled press, the white press, inflames the white public against Negroes. The police are able to use it to paint the Negro community as a criminal element. The police are able to use the press to make the white public think that 90% or 99% of the Negroes in the Negro community are criminals. And once the white public is convinced that most of the Negro community is a criminal element, then this automatically paves the way for the police to move into the Negro community, exercising Gestapo tactics, stopping any black man who is on the sidewalk, whether he is guilty or whether he is innocent, whether he is well-dressed or whether he is poorly dressed, whether he is educated or whether he is dumb, whether he's a Christian or whether he's a Muslim. As long as he is black and a member of the Negro community, the white public thinks that the white policeman is justified in going in there and trampling on that man's civil rights and on that man's human rights. Once the police have convinced the white public that the so-called Negro community is a criminal element, they can go in and question, brutalize, murder unarmed, innocent Negroes, and the white public is gullible enough to back them up. This makes the Negro community a police state. This makes the Negro neighborhood a police state. It's the most heavily patrolled. It has more police in it than any other neighborhood, yet it has more crime in it than any other neighborhood. How can you have more cops and more crime? Why? It shows you that the cops must be in cahoots with the criminals. The police, the same way. They put their club upside your head and then turn around and accuse you of attacking them. Every case of police brutality against a Negro follows the same pattern. They attack you, bust you all upside your mouth, and then take you to court and charge you with assault. What kind of democracy is that? What kind of freedom is that? What kind of social or political system is it when a black man has no voice in court, has nothing on his side other than what the white man chooses to give him? My brothers and sisters, we have to put a stop to this. And it will never be stopped until we stop it ourselves. They attack the victim, and then the criminal who attacked the victim accuses the victim of attacking him. This is American justice. This is American democracy. And those of you who are familiar with it know that in America, democracy is hypocrisy. Now, if I'm wrong, put me in jail. But if you can't prove that if democracy is not hypocrisy, then don't put your hands on me.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. We're in conversation this evening with Associate Professor of Journalism at Temple University, Professor Lynn Washington. He is with us. Professor Washington also has a law degree from Yale University, so he can speak on these legal issues that we're talking about, dealing with the FOP and their disrespect of black communities nationwide, in particular, and specifically in Philadelphia. We're going to go straight to the phones. Professor Washington, you still with us?
Okay, yes, I'm here.
We'll go straight to the phones. Caller, what's your name? Where you calling from?
This is Scotty calling from North Carolina. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Good evening to the host and to the guests. And it was right on time that you played that Malcolm X clip, because my question and comment is related to what the professor brought up about the United Nations. And, I follow that whole process and what have you. They actually visited several cities here in the United States. I believe it was last summer, if I'm not mistaken, went around in different NGOs, non-governmental organizations, local organizations, gave testimony. Some of that testimony was about police terrorism and what have you. But the United Nations, going back to the days of Malcolm X, Malcolm X did say you know, we need to take them to the UN and these world bodies and what have you. But these world bodies, they know about this stuff. The people, these people in these other countries that are major trade partners and have these seats at the United Nations, as the professor mentioned, you've even had organizations. I know one specifically. I talked to them, interviewed them from Chicago that made a presentation in the past year or two to the United Nations. We had these UN working groups, the political prisoners present to them, that community presents to the United Nations. So the United Nations is well aware of these things, but, you know, it ain't none of that worth nothing. No report coming out saying we found so-and-so to be occurring in the United States, like they said about solitary confinement is torture and how it's used in the United States. They can write all of reports pointing out, or even, you know, strongly worded, falling short of condemnation that they want to write. If there's no sanctions, like how they want to slap, everybody slapping sanctions on North Korea right now for testing nuclear weapons, or talking about slapping sanctions on Venezuela, freezing some of their former officials' bank accounts, then it don't amount to a hill of beans, okay? And I think that if these other people in these nations, other nations, and again, like Africa, it's hard to point to Africa and look for any leadership there because, I mean, they're suffering their own human rights abuses. And you see how they just let a member of the African Union, Libya, NATO, just run up in there and murder all them people, and they ain't doing nothing right now while them Arabs in Libya practicing open market slavery, okay? So, I mean, I know I said a lot there. I'm just, you know, I don't know what the solutions are, you know, because the UN is aware of these things. And when it comes to the United States, the UN is toothless. You know, words on a piece of paper on a report don't mean nothing. Where are the sanctions for these human rights violations? And then, you know, I look at policing as nothing but slave catching. In the modern era of 13th Amendment, approve slavery and human trafficking through the courts and through the prisons. So that's in conflict or violation of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights on Slavery, which says all forms of slavery shall be abolished. But here the United States and its Constitution say, oh, we can still use that in involuntary servitude as quote-unquote punishment for crime. And I don't want to recount the whole 150-year history of convict leasing or some variation thereof. But, again, the only solution I see is what Malcolm said. And I know in that context he was speaking exclusively of black people, but post-Nation of Islam, I just watched a clip of him today saying that these anti-racist whites, if y'all serious about it, then you need to be providing intelligence on the Klan organization, infiltrate the Klan, and then give the right organizations the right people. Give it to the information to the people and let us know. So he talking about counterintelligence work. So the same thing go with these police departments. And then for us to have black cops, you know, in these institutions and then allowing themselves to be mistreated like that. I never heard that story before, of cops and their wives getting beat up. And y'all, and they let it happen? Man, it would have been a fight down in that bar if somebody assaulted my wife. So, again, I mean, what is wrong with these people? The only solution is for, I don't care what your skin color is, but it's for you to stand on justice and principles and inform on these people. We got all these alternative media outlets that you can record these people, and you got WikiLeaks that, you know, so I don't want to make the solution going to come from the people themselves, not from the government, not from the UN, in my opinion. And I'll listen to your comments off here. Thank you for taking my call, Elliot.
Thank you for your call, sir. Professor Washington?
Yes. Scotty brings up a lot of good points, and this is where we get into like the structural and administrative side of things. Yes, these reports are toothless, but it's good to have them because they document them. And, you know, I guess at some point you can stack them to the ceiling and say, okay, here's showing the problem. Why isn't anything being done with it?
Okay.
One of the reasons why there will be no sanctions is because sanctions have to come not through the General Assembly, but through the Security Council. And any member of the Security Council can veto any effort for sanctions. So America will never allow itself to be sanctioned. However, there can be some things or should be some things that we could creatively come up with to deal with this problem. And I think that one of the issues is that the leadership, as well as the community, has not been consistent on this. One of the things that you started with this evening, Elliot, is the silence of black elected officials on what the FOP president said.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't hear them start issuing press releases until late last week, like almost two weeks after it was over. And it these press releases come out saying, oh, I find this objectionable. That only happened because, you know, the community people started making a ruckus out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And on another radio station, one of the hosts was, you know, on a tear about it and wrote a column in the Daily News where he called out a few people. And then all of a sudden, these people said, oh, yes, I just remembered this. This is bad. You should have been on it day one, and you weren't. But there's, again, when we look at history in Philadelphia, in 1918, there was a bad problem in Philadelphia called police brutality. This has been going on for decades. And there was an organization that founded or was created in 1918 called the Colored Protective Association. And its mission in part was to address the issue of police brutality in the city of Philadelphia. And it was done because the Urban League and the NAACP at that time were not aggressive enough in dealing with this particular issue. what is the solution? You know, I'm not really sure, but I know one thing that, you know, we cannot allow this to happen, or we cannot do it like episodically. Oh, we're upset about David Jones, and then we let the thing fall back.
Okay.
And in the next instance, you know, 2 or 3 years from now, oh, yeah, we're going to do this. But in the meantime, you know, people being mashed up and, you know, brutalized. And let's never lose sight of the fact that the most rampant form of police brutality is not fatal shootings, although that's outrageous. It's not even physical abuse, which is egregious. It's false arrests.
Mm-hmm.
They know that they're arresting the wrong person, and they don't care because it's overtime for them, and then they get chewed up in the court system, and next thing you know, they're at SCI Albion, which is in the western part of the state, and they're there for 5, 6, 7, 10, 20 years for something that they didn't do. At a rate of about $34,000 a year to keep one person in one cell in the Pennsylvania prison system. We're not talking about jails. We're talking about the state prison system that now has a little less than 50,000 people in it. This is outrageous, but, you know, our elected officials are not collecting the dots, and they're not standing up consistently enough.
Let's go to two.
If I may, Elliot, and Professor Washington, I can only provide a comment because I agree with all what you said. And one is that, you know, as you said, going to 1917, what comes to mind, and, you know, by me being doing tours at the museum, we look at the colonial African-American in Philadelphia in the colonial period. And when we talk about those private fire departments,
right,
were Irish and Scott-Irish and white and was a part of the Democratic machine, they became the police. And their role, even when they were the private fire department, was to contain blacks who had their own fire department from being able to fight fires out of an economic and out of a racial context. So we could see, you know, it's important. Like as you raised, it's important to understand that this is a historical legacy as it relates to us and how we're being handled by the police department. And the other part that, you know, you raised that systemic question about the
the economic part, locking people up, and Brother Scotty was making alluded and developed that point too, locking people up because of the economic benefit, whether they did the crime or not,
right,
for a group of people within this system, just by them, they get overtime, the private, even the state gets funding from it, the private, those suburban or rural areas get employment from it. So it becomes an industry in locking up Black people in Philadelphia, which is the, I think it's Philadelphia and Pittsburgh are the largest percentage of people in those prison populations in the state. So and so the my last thing is that, and this gets very abstract, it seems that we can never really deal with the UN question until African Americans decide that we are approaching as a entity compared to complaining about an issue. Mm-hmm. And that's an internal, infrastructural, legal thing that we have to go through that we have been told we should consider, but we've never considered, even at a local level, to operate in that fashion. And so it goes on. So I just, that, you know, that's the, you know, when you raise that, it's kind of sparked that, those points for me in this dialogue.
Let me.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
In reporting, they always say, you know, follow the money. And when we look at this issue of mass incarceration, we're talking about money. Let's just look at Pennsylvania. A little less than 50,000 people in the prison system. Of all of the people that are in the prison system, there's 68 counties in Pennsylvania. One-third of all of the inmates in the Pennsylvania prison system come from one county. One county. And that county is Philadelphia County. Now, Philadelphia County and Allegheny County, where Pittsburgh is in Allegheny County, have about the same amount of people. But Philadelphia is sending more people there. So this notion that, you know, judges in Philadelphia are soft and they're not putting, you know, they're not cracking down hard enough on criminals is nonsense. We could see this. The Pennsylvania prison system, the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, their budget annually is like about $2 billion. So when somebody in the public hears that, said, okay, well, these prisoners, $2 billion? What's going on here? Do they have flat-screen TVs in their cells? Do they eat filet mignon? If you listen to Fox News, you would think they do. But the reality is that 95% of that $2 billion budget goes for salary and benefits for the 15,000 employees of the Pennsylvania prison system. Mm. And the overwhelming majority of those employees are white. They being the state, opened up a new prison in a place called Forest County. Forest County is in northwestern Pennsylvania. It's near the town of Erie and in the county of Erie. It's so far out there, really. I mean, there's like 3,000 people in the whole town. They needed jobs, so they lobbied to get a prison built. And that prison now has about a little less than 4,000 people in it, the majority of whom are Black. Mm-hmm. So this county where white people are getting jobs, it's just like slavery again. It's just like kind of like tweaked and flipped. They wanted and needed jobs. The state said, okay, we'll build a prison out there. So they build they bring the Black people out there. And then again, to show you how this economic system is worked out, because the prisoners are poor, and they're poor because they don't work, and because they're a minority, Forest County now gets money from the state and the government based on the level of impoverishment of just straight demographics. Well, we got so many Black people there. Yeah, but the Black people ain't living there. They're living in the prison.
Mm.
And they're able to get more money and more political representation based on those incarcerated people. And again, we see this time and time again replicated all across the country. And for some reason, these dots are not being connected enough. There is a number of people out there doing good work and have been doing good work for decades, but we don't listen to them. We'll listen to a rap artist. you know, and not even a conscious rapper, will listen to these mega preachers. God, I mean, you talk about going in different directions. We knew that there was a DA in Philadelphia who was anti-black. And I'm not just talking about Len Abraham. I'm talking about Len Abraham's successor, a guy named Seth Williams. He did so many negative things to black people. Yet, in the run-up to this year's DA's race, when Seth was still in the race, there were a number of prominent black leaders in the city of Philadelphia who were prepared to back the re-election of Seth Williams, despite all of the despicable things that he did to black people.
Yep.
Like that young boy who was an honor student at a charter school who was going to play basketball.
Exactly.
And, you know, got molested on the street by a cop, by a white female cop. And to prove that that didn't happen, Seth convened a grand jury. And then he came out and insulted the kid's mother. Yet black people were still going to support this guy. And then he withdrew because he knew that he was getting ready to be indicted. And now the dude is sitting in jail. Now, we knew that the dude was dirty. And if not for the corruption that led to his conviction, or actually his guilty plea, but the things that he was doing, like with that young boy, or opposing or creating nonsense around the Mumia Abu-Jamal case. Let's remember that when Obama elected a guy from the legal NAACP's Legal Defense Fund to be the civil rights head in his Justice Department, and at the time, this guy, Debo Adebele, I always mispronounce his last name, he was working on the staff of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. Yet when he went up for his confirmation, the senators went in lockstep with the FOP. The FOP said, well, this guy is the one who represented Mumia Abu-Jamal and helped get him off of death row. That was a flat lie because he didn't do that. The person who got Abu-Jamal off of death row is a law professor at Widener's Law School down in Wilmington. Okay, so this guy had nothing to do with that. The FOP initiated a two-page letter, and on the second page, you saw what their thing was. They said that they were afraid that Debo was going to initiate more investigations of police, and they didn't want to have it. So you had Toomey, Senator Toomey from the United States, and Seth Williams were at the point in terms of sabotaging this man's nomination. Bob Casey went along with it, and also Chris Coons from Delaware. Now, what shows you how just repugnant this thing is, Chris Coons is the Democratic senator from Delaware. He has an office in Wilmington. If he was concerned about facts and truth, he could have got on the phone and called Professor Judith Ritter at the Widener Law School, which is located on 202 right off of I-95, even if he didn't want to take that five-minute drive from Wilmington out to the law school to talk to her, he could have gone on the phone and had one of his staff members do it. But they didn't do it. They perpetuated a lie that was promulgated by the FOP, and everybody went along with it. Time after time after time. Bipartisan, biracial, but the only thing that but it still keeps the foot on the neck of black people. And Hispanic people.
Let's go to 267, area code 267. 267, yes.
Yes, Brother Elliot, how are you, sir?
Great, how are you?
Good, Brother Richard.
Yeah, how you doing now?
Yeah, one of my favorite people on here, Lynn Washington. You know, Lynn Washington, I got to give a little introduction of you, man. And, you know, you have made people in Philadelphia much better and given them shots that you never even realized. I can remember in the early 90s and all my activist days in the 80s, I was referred to you by a guy by the name of Brother Spady, Sam Spady. Oh, and yeah, that's right. And he said, there's a guy, Tim, that if you can't get Helen Blue, get him. And he said, Tim, he will listen to what you're saying and he'll print your article. And I said, well, I had just started graduate school at Beaver College in 94. So I went to you, and I had various politicians come to my events and open it up, and we had, I had written this article, and I said, "What do you think about this?" And you know what? It's real funny now. So he said, "Yeah, hey man, you want to say, hey man, I should tear this up, but you didn't do that." He said, "I'll look at it. I'll look at it. Okay, and you printed that for me, and that's what you did for me. Let me know that." I could write, but I got to work on it. I just started graduate school. I never forget that. I mean, I'm undergrad, you're thinking 101 expository writing 102. You're not into heavy depth writing where you're writing out of newspaper, not just your journalism. Not just your journalism major. I was an English major. But, and with that, man, you've always had that ingredient in that theme from Move to Mumia. And I could see you opening up with Black Lives Matter. And I'm going to say that in that time period, in the early 80s, these were important papers that would bring about the injustices of the community, whether it was police brutality, whether somebody was preying on our community, with housing, economics, whatever the problem was. And it was people like you, Helen Blue, Spady, and Spady introduced another person. He said, "Tim, you can't always get something in the New Observer." He introduced me to Kendall Wilson. That was the other part of it. From Kendall Wilson, I met Barnett. Terry Hurd and I became friends, and at that time, with radio and newspaper, we're doing so much grassroots work, and all we needed now, that vehicles was maybe television. We never really got that far, but you, especially when it comes to URD, a person like you comes on URD in that morning slot. Nobody can do that like you. I hope you're always still around, because you would bring about the form of the platform for Black Lives Matter to come about, for the injustice of a police officer. You shine a light. And my thing is that I hope it doesn't go anywhere, because is it popular now for certain radio stations to come against the politicians? Because are they going to turn around and change the flavor of it, or are they going to continually do it? Because we need somebody to continually stay on the spot of what the injustice of the police department, the school district, the politician, the economics in our community. And, I mean, and Lynn, I'm pretty sure you don't have to be in those places, man. You don't have to do the job you do. You can do a whole lot of things as opposed to this. But one thing I like about you, whether you're on the street, or whether you're at a meeting, or whether you're working with another person, everybody knows that Lynn Washington is going to open it up. He's with the community, and he's very grassroots. So listen, I feel blessed that I was come across a person like you. And another person I want to mention, too, during his time period, he doesn't have anymore, it's the Real News, with Terry Johnson. Mm-hmm. Terry Johnson and his staff writers, the stuff that they used to print, and I hardly never, and New Observer's not around anymore with you, Roe Warren. Terry Hurd's not long around anymore. And sometimes the Tribune will let certain things come out, because when I was writing the Tribune, Manny Marble right out of there, Dr. Lonnie Gamir right out of there. They don't have all those type of staff writers anymore. So when you're still around and you still have that vehicle, you are letting the community know what is going on. So my question to you, I want you to still be around. Keep it up. How do we keep it up? How do we survive? And where do we go from now? And in other words, this is real news, not fake news. And we need to hear it. We need to know it. We need to Tribune with URD and with any other Black connection of media working towards our goals to get us out of this. Not code it and be connected with us with the corruption, but to knock it down and put it out of here, because that's what's slowing us down as a race.
Thank you for your call.
Indeed.
Well, it's good to talk to Tim. I usually run into him on the street down in Center City. I haven't seen him in a couple of years. But the point that he raised about what we need to do, we need to continue. Like forums like this, you know, LA, the program that you have, the various news publications that we have, the radio voices that we have, we need to continue that and do more of it. But it's not just those who do. It's those who receive. You know, why is it that in the Black community there's more credibility given to what is in the Enquirer or what is in the Daily News versus what's in the Tribune.
Okay.
I remember when I was the editor for the New Observer, I actually had Helen Blue, which Tim referenced, I had her do a story on how so many black elected officials will always cite something in the white press and in the process demean black media, but when their backsides get in trouble with the white press, they're running to the black media to help them out. And it was one of the difficult stories because nobody wanted to talk to her. Nobody was going to be, you know, man up or woman up and say, we actually put more credibility in white folks. It's just amazing. You know, Malcolm X said that the Negro is his own worst enemy. Mm-hmm. He said that in the early 60s, and we could say that today, and it still has the same meaning or perhaps more, because we should have learned in the ensuing decades that we got to do better. We'll never have 100% unity. But we have to know, and it's incumbent upon us to know these things.
Scotty,
when he called, he's from North Carolina. Well, in November of 1898, there was a riot in Wilmington, North Carolina. White folks didn't want black folks to have jobs. A former congressman who was a colonel in the Confederate Army literally led a revolution in that town and ran all the black leaders out. They burned down the black newspaper there, the guy named Alexander Munley. He was the editor. He had taken issue with a white woman who said that it's good to have lynchings because that helps protect black women. He wrote, and perhaps a little too honestly, but he said, listen, you know, you white men better do something with your women because, you know, they're dealing with black men in congenial relationships that are sexual because you ain't taking care of business. You know, you can imagine that in flames. But the point is, they had this riot. They ran black people out of town. They burned down this and that. The president wouldn't send the army in. The governor of North Carolina wouldn't send the National Guard in until days after this. Then the people who rebelled, this Confederate colonel and his Confederates, took over the town, and they allowed them to continue. Nobody went to jail. So we see these instances time and time and time again, but we don't even know this. This is our history.
I know it.
But see, we're satisfied with McDonald's saying, you know, we'll put some kente cloth around our, you know, $1 hamburger menu, and that's black power. Martin Luther King, he was a great man. He was a dreamer. Look at the I Have a Dream speech. The dream part is like two paragraphs in like a 40 or 50 paragraph speech. The most of it's not the dream, it's the nightmare of America. And in Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, he twice, by name, condemns police brutality. Now, every year we have a Martin Luther King breakfast or luncheon or whatever in one of these hotels in Center City here in Philadelphia. When do they ever stand up and say, well, today we're going to talk about the nightmare. We're not going to talk about the dream. But we're going to all stand up and, you know, well, we shall overcome and we're going to talk about the dream. What about the nightmare that we're still living?
Yeah, it's too many
if
of our...
If we don't raise it, it ain't going to get raised.
And too many of our people let other people set the narrative or set the parameters, and that's what some of us follow. It's sad.
Ellie, before you go to another call, can I ask Professor Washington you were saying earlier that you wanted to get back on defining the grand jury. It's important we understand these mechanisms.
Trust me, you know, we hear so much about grand jury, and over the last 2 years, so many of these police murders. Let me rephrase that. These murders by police have been sent to grand juries. And the impression is that we have a group of citizens who review the evidence and make a determination. Structurally, grand juries are run by prosecutors. So the information that comes to the grand jury is whatever the prosecutor allows to come in. So if the prosecutor says, well, I don't want you to know that this particular police officer has shot three other people paralyzed two in the fatal one, but we're not going to bring that up. We're just going to look at this one incident. So there's a misperception about who has the power with the grand jury. The grand jury generally issues a report. Now, please, do you think that 15 laymen, and I'm not saying that the people are dumb, please don't, these could be all smart people, they could be all college professors, but they're not going to sit down and write a report in legalese? They don't know how to do this. This is done by prosecutors. So when the prosecutor comes in and says that we don't think there's enough criminal intent here, and what say you, grand jury? Well, yes, we agree with that. How can you have a grand jury in an instance like the move, that Holocaust out on Osage Avenue, where they killed five children, in the move commission, this non-binding, non-legal commission that that Mayor Good set up, they said that the deaths of those children were unjustified homicides. And they reached that finding in part because when they did the autopsy on the children, as well as some of the adults there, you know, in the charred bones that they were able to get out of that house, they found buckshot inside the bodies of those people. Now, if they weren't outside of the house at some point, how were they shot with buckshot? The only people who had buckshot that day were police officers. Okay? So then the grand jury turns around and says, well, there's no evidence of any wrongdoing by anybody, including the police commissioner who lied on a number of instances. So we need to have better understanding of some of these structural dynamics that go on. And that's just one of them with the grand jury. I'm sure you and a lot of your listeners remember the incident where a Philadelphia police officer, actually he was a lieutenant, punched a woman at a Puerto Rican Day parade, mm-hmm. knocked her down, right? And they put him on trial. Well, it was a trial at the municipal court level, the district court level. Every day, police officers came in and packed it, the courtroom, in support of this guy. The judge who handled the case ruled that there wasn't enough evidence that he intended to hurt the woman because he claimed that he was just trying to smack a can of beer or what he thought was a can of beer out of her hands. But he just inadvertently, by the time he was going to do an open hand slap, it became a fist and he punched the stuffings out of this woman. Aside from the fact that if he smacks the beer can out, what's going to stop the beer can, if it was a beer can, from hitting a baby in a carriage nearby? I mean, that was reckless behavior. That should have been a crime. But this particular judge, one of the police officers who was sitting there during this trial every day was the judge's wife. She's a cop. That should never have happened, and if it did, which it did, the judge, under the judicial ethics, had an obligation to withdraw from the case. I cannot be on this case because it would give the appearance of impropriety because my wife is sitting in the courtroom every day supporting the defendant in this case. Now, that is bad enough. But why didn't the district attorney's office, the district attorney that was run at the time by Seth Williams, why didn't they know that the wife of the judge who's on this police brutality case is a police officer who was coming into the courtroom? And if, in fact, you didn't know it, which raises the question, why are you so dumb that you don't know it? If you didn't know it, then after the decision was made, it was incumbent upon you to file a complaint with the Judicial Ethics Board about that judge's violation of ethics, and it never happened. So this is yet another example of how the system is manipulated and perverted, bent and twisted to help police officers.
We're in conversation with Associate Professor of Journalism at Temple University, Professor Lynn Washington is with us. I'm glad you stayed a little bit over time, Professor Washington. We're going to try to get a couple of these callers on before you have to go.
I'll keep my comments short.
215, area code, 215.
Hey, Brother Elliot, how you doing, man?
How are you, sir?
Hey, Brother Richard.
How you doing, though?
I'm doing fine. Hey, Professor Washington, how you doing, good brother?
Okay, man, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Brother, man, let me say this before I get deep into the conversation. A couple things. When Brother Scotty called in from North Carolina, you know, And you brought up about the black police officers. He said how they sat back and let them white cops disrespect their wives and everything and themselves in the process. Well, you know, when Malcolm was in the Nation, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, through his spokesperson, Brother Malcolm, he put out an edit for black, this was done back in the 60s, Professor Washington, he put out an edit for black police officers to follow across the country when dealing with our people and also with dealing with the racist white cops that they work with. If black cops had followed that edit back then, you would see a whole different mentality, Brother Lynn, with black cops today. But so many of them Negroes, they so cowardly, so ignorant, they didn't follow it. And this is why they get disrespected by their fellow white cops. And now people continue to get disrespected. Had they followed the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, you would see a whole totally different mindset among black cops today. And also, too, Brother Lynn, when you mentioned about that terrorism thing, about how they – how McNesby, that old devil, sit there and said that he called Black Lives Matter terrorist group. See, that's the play, like they said, and like you said, Professor Lynn, that's very dangerous because actually you bringing in this homeland security terrorism where they can come out and invade your mosque. Because you might bring that up to your attention, Brother Washington, because several years ago when Commissioner Johnson was police commissioner, it was one of McNesby's underlings, one of his cohorts. They tried the same thing. Brother, as you know, Sylvester Johnson is a Muslim, and he was going to this masjid up in the Germantown Mount area. I forgot exactly where it was at, but it's somewhere up in the area. He would go to Juma prayer on Fridays. And, you know, as American citizens, so-called American citizens, Brother Lynn, you have a right to speak out and speak against injustice. Well, at this masjid, on one of their services, they were speaking against the unfair policy between Israel and the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And as you well know, this government loves to send Negroes in mosques to be infiltrators and stuff like that. So this one Negro that was there, supposed to be a Muslim, he was number informant. So he went back and told the police, the FBI, that these people that spoke against America, these brothers in the mosque, and they was planning to overthrow America. So one of McNesby underlings came out in the white press and said, well, you know, that mosque need to be investigated for terrorism, for plotting to overthrow the government. All this is foolishness. Sylvester Johnson, to his credit, he came out and defended the mosque. He said, I go there for Juma prayer, and them lost by brothers in that mosque. He said, I'm not going to sit there and let you defame that mosque, he said, because I go there myself for Juma prayer. So bottom line, Brother Lynn, because of Sylvester Johnson standing strong, he was able to get them to back down and stuff. They was going to do all kinds of stuff to that mosque just because the brothers spoke out against the unfair occupation of Palestine by the Zionists. So you see clearly what kind of mindset you're dealing with in this country now. See, freedom of speech, that's only for white folks. That's not for us. Yeah. You know what I mean? So you see clearly the mindset you're dealing with. And Professor Lynn, I'm so glad that, like Brother Tim said before me, if we have more people like you in the black press, our conditions as a people, I'm not just saying it just to make you feel, I'm just saying it because I wouldn't say it, Brother Lynn, if it wasn't true, because I run into you sometime down Temple 2 sometimes. I don't remember me. I tell you, I hear you on Solomon Show. And I said to you tonight, if we have more brothers like you in the press that's not afraid to speak truth to power, because see, you got many black journalists that support Brother Mumia, but they scared to say it publicly. You're not afraid to say it publicly. You're a man. You step up to the place and say, look, I support the brother and hope he get justice. Well, you might have other black reporters that feel the same way, but they're afraid of offending their white colleagues, so they say it in secret. They treat Mumia, Brother Lynn, the same way they do Minister Farrakhan. Because I know Brother Minister Farrakhan said many times he had black leaders, I'm talking about in the Senate, in the Congress, and if among them on the federal state level, they'll come to him on the side. Like the minister, y'all treat me like I'm a prostitute. You come to me in the dark at night saying, Brother Farrell, can I support you? But, you know, I can't say it publicly because, you know, the Jews get upset with me, the white folks, so I gotta keep you at the arms about do to support you and stuff like that. See, what kind of coward leadership is that? If you're a man, step up to the plate and be a man. You know, right. if you support Minister Farrakhan, stay in public. Why, you ever notice, Brother Lynn, white folks don't give a damn what black people think. When they support a white bigot, they don't care whether black people like it or not. How many times you have seen white leaders, whether it be Democrat or Republican, whether it be a Donald Trump, whether it be a Ronald Reagan, they don't sit there and hide it. Or that thug over in Israel, Netanyahu, they don't care what black people think. They support them publicly. But we got to do stuff behind closed doors because we're so damn scared and cowardly.
Well, listen, Joe, let me say something in reference to what you just said. Because I remember a comment made by, excuse me, the representative Bob Brady,
mm-hmm.
that stated because black folks was vehemently angry with the Republicans and they downing different Republicans. And he mentioned that he was good friends with John Boehner.
Correct. And Paul Ryan.
That they were good friends.
Yes, that's what he said.
So
what he said.
How does that seem to work?
See again, Brother Elliot, it's just like you saying, like, and that's what I'm echoing with to Brother Lenny and you and Brother Richard. See, white folks don't care what black people think. And matter of fact, he said it, and he was quoted in the Surface Sunday Sun, Bob Brady's exact words. He said that though we're on a different side politically, I consider Speaker Paul Ryan one of my best friends and stuff. I'm saying, really? Yet this sucker putting policies in place to hurt black people, to hurt poor people, and you claim to be a representative district, a congressional district. It represents predominantly black people, and you friends with this guy? Well, you friends with him, you damn sure ain't no friend of the black community. But see, black people let that stuff go unchallenged. See, and again, it all goes back, Brother Elliot, Brother Rich, and Brother Len. Again, white folks' arrogance, that's that part of that white supremacy. They don't care what we think. They support their white fellow bigots. Like, stuff don't matter whether they really like it or not, but we're so scared to defend our people and stuff like that. That's why, like I said, I respect Brother Len, because Len support my mayor publicly. He support my mayor privately and stuff. And what's wrong with Brother Len supporting my mayor? If he thought that the mayor got a raw deal and that he's innocent, he has a right as a so-called citizen in this country to support my mayor. But see, black people, they so afraid that they go get on the wrong side of white folks that they is kowtow, you know. And when you kowtow to these people, they have no respect for them. Oh, they'll use you, but they have no respect for you because you don't have enough heart to stand up for your own people and your own stuff and your own heritage. How you expect white people to have any respect for you? See, that's the way I am. I'm a 56-year-old black man. I don't give a damn whether white people like what I say or not. I could care less. That's when I was working on the job and at the hospital. I know white people don't like some of the things I said as far as about, you know, racism and everything, but I could care less because I know they live in their world. I live in my world. I know what it's like to be walk around this black skin every day, so I could give a damn whether they liked it or not. I could care less, you know, but so many of our people, we want to curry favor with them, so we just go ahead and go along to get along. And as long as we go along to get along, our conditions with the people will never change. Because we see clearly these people got an agenda, and the agenda definitely don't include us. Only thing when it includes us, only thing it includes is us continuing to fill up these prisons. Like Brother Lim was saying earlier, you got Philadelphia who sent more black people to prison, these judges and stuff, than any county in the state of Pennsylvania. Because people don't realize Pennsylvania is a really, really big state. And when you get outside, the more you get outside of Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, you see how white the state is. I mean, I've been up to upstate Pennsylvania. You go up to some states, Carbon County, Luzerne County. I've been all up some areas before. Only thing black you see up there a lot of times is the roads. And that's the truth, man.
Compensated, you know, some of these counties, there's more black bears than there are black people.
and that's the lie, brother. And I've been all through upstate on many.
I never heard it put quite like that.
It's the truth, brother. It is the honest God truth, man. When you get outside of Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, you don't see a lot of black folks in these areas. You might see one or two here and there, but you, like Brother Lynn said, you see more black bears than you see black folks, man. So we got our work to do, man, and that's why I applaud Brother Lynn for having the courage to speak truth to power. And Brother Lynn's not a hateful person. He's a lover like I am of humanity and stuff, but you just sometimes as a black man, you got to speak the truth. Like I said, when that white girl... And I'll close with these last couple of remarks. When that white girl got killed down in Virginia for that white thug, I felt my heart went out to her and her family, man, because I'm a Muslim. I care about humanity and stuff. I don't go around wishing bad on white people or anything. I just want to see justice for my people, and we have got to have black people that have enough heart to speak truth to power. But so many of us, we're too scared. We don't carry favor. And it's like these black cops with FOP in the police department. They should be ashamed of themselves how cowardly they are. They sit back here and watch these white cops mistreat people that look just like them and they ain't got no heart. But yet them same black cops, like that black cop that Brother Lane you spoke of, that slapped that Puerto Rican girl at the Puerto Rican Day Parade. Brother Lane, you know and I know, and I said this on WRD many times, that Negro knew where he was at. If he was down in South Philadelphia at the Columbus Day Parade or at the Irish St. Paddy's Day Parade, if a white girl would have spit on that Negro, he wouldn't have done a damn thing. Because he knew the white boys would have whipped his ass. But see, he felt comfortable slapping that girl because he knew nothing's going to be done about it. See, them Negroes know what time it is. That's why no matter what white people do to them Negroes, they take it. And I close with this, Len. You remember the incident with the white girl from Channel 17? Remember back here early this year, she was reported for Channel 17. It was a black cop and a white, because she got all drunk, liquored up at the club down South Street. So she was out of unruly. So they was trying to calm her down. She was calling the black cop and the white cop all kinds of names. They didn't do nothing. I mean, they sat there and took all that abuse. If that had been a black woman, that black cop would have slapped her down, put his knee on her, but he knew better to put his hands on that white woman, because he knew what the consequences would have been. See, them niggas know what time it is, man. But they know.
Thank you for your call.
But anyway, brother, man, thanks for the time. It was an honor talking to you tonight, man. And you keep up the good work, brother Len and Elliot and Rich. I hope y'all can have brother Len on again in the future, because he's a gem among our people, man, because he's a brother that has the courage of his conviction. That's all I ask for any black man or woman to have, is the courage of their convictions. That's all.
Thank you for your call.
You're welcome, brother Elliot.
Professor Washington, if you got a few minutes, I just want to clear this board. There's a couple more calls.
Yeah, please.
And before we go to the next caller, I just want to mention something, because you talked earlier about our people being too reactionary about a lot of these things. And I believe that we should start having some type of concrete plans on how we're going to deal not only with these incidents, but deal in the society moving forward. We don't have a war strategy when dealing with or living in a white supremacist society, and we should, because, you know, a lot of these organizations, even an organization like the Urban League, which I don't consider a grassroots organization, they said in several of their reports that in every strata of life, black people are under attack. So if black people realize, and even bourgeois black people realize, that black people are under attack, then if you're under attack in any means, then you need to develop some type of war strategy. We don't have a war strategy when it comes to dealing with European society, Europeans in particular. We don't. Because we try in some of our minds to rationalize behavior to a certain extent, and to look for friends when the only friends we're going to have is ourselves. I just want to throw that out there before I go to the next caller. And I want to mention this also, because I think that we have to monitor these things. We see here that the officer that was involved in the shooting of David Jones was fired by the police department, if I'm not mistaken.
A suspended with intent to dismiss.
Okay. Now, if we realize that these FOPs around the country look out for police, and if you look at it, like a Darren Wilson down in Ferguson, look at the officer that shot the young child, Tamir Rice. These officers came from other departments and were dismissed or transferred or whatever, and ended up, Darren Wilson ended up in Ferguson. The other guy ended up in Cleveland and did similar incidents to what was going on before. So I wouldn't be surprised if this officer that was dismissed for shooting two black men, one paralyzed and one he murdered, or end up somewhere else on a police department or in law enforcement. Of course, that's how it works. We just don't have a lot of black media to follow these guys and follow the breadcrumbs and see what's going on.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there needs to be more media attention, but we need to have those resources within black media so they can do that.
Yes.
With this guy here in Philadelphia, the process is that he will be discharged, fired from the police department, and they have to go through this procedure, suspended until he's discharged. If he's not criminally prosecuted and he's not convicted, then what's going to happen is the FOP is going to try to get his job back through arbitration.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Nutter, former Mayor Michael Nutter, in one of the contract negotiations with the FOP, kicked in $2.5 million to the FOP's legal defense fund. And that's the fund that the FOP uses to do these arbitrations to get the jobs back for people who have been engaged in gross brutality. The FOP, this is so ironic, when Michael Nutter pushed for the revival of civilian review of police in 1993, he had to fight Lynn Abraham, the DA. He had to fight the then mayor of the city of Philadelphia, a guy named Ed Rendell. Now, Ed Rendell was able to become mayor in part because he served as DA in the city of Philadelphia And when Ed Rendell was running for DA of the city of Philadelphia in, what, 76 or 77, one of his main campaign planks was that he was going to address police brutality. But when the Nutter was able to get Rendell to sign an executive order to create the Police Advisory Commission, the agency that took them to court and fought it all the way up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court level was the FOP. And they were able to do it in part from the money that they get from the cities of Philadelphia into their legal defense fund. And that money that goes into that legal defense fund is taxpayer money. When there's a settlement in these police brutality suits, the settlement comes out of taxpayer money. So you're actually being robbed left and right. You're getting beat up. You're getting brutalized. You're getting all your rights taken away from you, or should we say disrespected. And then you turn around the money that you put in that doesn't go to educating your children, that doesn't go to lowering your property taxes, you're still being ripped off. And it's just amazing. And then that just goes back to where you started at the beginning of the show. Where are black elected officials connecting these dots and saying, this is wrong. It's been going on for too long. We're going to stop it right now, today. Somebody down there in city council has the power to at least raise that issue, that we just had a contract signed by the police department and with the police department. Why wasn't there any issues about the arbitration process? This isn't to become news now. We've known about this for decades, and nothing substantively was done to try to rein that in.
Let's go to 646, area code 646. 646? 646.
Yes, good evening, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Just a quick question for your guest. I just like to know, with all of the things that go along in these areas like Philadelphia, New York, and other cities, has there been any type of sustained action against the police in regards to the brutality of our people? Have there ever been a collective of any group that has been able to fight back against them killing us? Because from what I see, you know, nothing really happens to these police officers. They either get a fake jury trial, or they go in front of a judge and have a trial. Then if they're found not guilty, they're back on the force. Some of them go back out on the street. Some of them get a cushy desk job. But in the process, the one thing that it seems to me that the state will do is pay the family off. You know what I mean? So, in essence, we'll give you a couple of dollars to let it go away, but we won't make any systemic changes to the fact that we're killing your people. And it seems like that's all right because, you know, unfortunately, you know, if you get someone like Crime Daddy Shopping involved, he's basically going to lead you to an attorney that's going to get you some money, and then he's probably going to get his cut, and business just going to go on as usual. So how do we win in these situations? How do we systemically change the oppression that we're facing within the system? And you know, you were talking about early Pennsylvania, I think it was, in the prison that they built there. They ain't no telling what type of abuse the prisoners there are suffering at the hands of them Neanderthals, because most of them ain't never been around black folks until they see them in the jail. And they KKK members, if you ask me.
Yeah, well, there is a prison up north of Reading. I think it's called Frackville. And they found a cell of racist skinheads within the guards there. But more to your question, your inquiry in terms of what organizations are doing things. Organizations all across the country are working on these issues. Unfortunately, you know, you get one little victory here, one little victory there, but systemically things don't change. So we need some kind of new strategy. I mean, we might need to do what King and in many ways what Malcolm was talking about, and that's to have some economic withdrawal. We need to punish some corporations for their involvement in this. Another thing that what we need to do, we need to be more strategic in terms of who we back politically. Many of these black elected officials have been in office 5, 10, 15, 20 years, established friendships with people. Every year give this, summer cookout, free hot dogs and hamburgers. But if you're not doing anything to systemically change, to make laws, or to at least stand up consistently, then maybe you don't need to be there. And if there was more political participation among blacks and more strategic political participation, there could set off a ripple effect where, some things will change. But we have to accept the fact that we live in a deeply racist country. This is not something that we need to study anymore. We know it is. We've shown that. I mean, what Richard was talking about in terms of these fire companies, they, back in, colonial, post-colonial times, people would get money for putting out a fire. And some of those fire companies would actually set the fire so they can go put them out and get paid. And no, they didn't want black people cutting in on their money. Mm-hmm. There was some of the first race riots in Philadelphia were white people saying, we don't want black people to have jobs here and there. Mm-hmm. We know what the history is, or we know that the history is there. We don't know enough of it. But we have to be consistent about this. And unfortunately, I see this as like a long distance marathon relay. And it's bad. I mean, that now in 2017, we're still fighting the fights that people were fighting in the 60s, but it's our responsibility to fight that fight. And a relay race is not all Usain Bolt running a 100-meter leg and doing it in, faster than anybody else has ever done it in the world. This is long distance, we all have a responsibility to make a contribution wherever we can make it. And when we get back to politics, that's something easy. All you have to do is go cast a vote twice a year, in the primary and in the general election. And the way that the politics is turning in the country where fewer and fewer people are voting, if that's the case, then elections can be swayed by smaller and smaller groups if those groups vote in a block.
Mm-hmm.
We can change some things around. And I'm not saying that politics is the be-all and the end-all, because when black people, when they have made progress, some of the best progress that has been made is this inside-outside strategy. We put political pressure on the political system, but we still have things outside in terms of protests and taking some independent action.
Jay, was that?
I don't know honestly about the political system. I don't see it as a viable form of rehabilitation for these white folks, and I don't see how it has helped us as a people based alone on us dealing with Barack Obama and some of the other elected officials that are in office that they get in there and don't do anything at all for us or, the community. So, I mean, I don't know. I just don't think that electing someone, placing them in office is going to change the narrative that we face in this country. I think we need to, myself, come up with a situation to where as we punish them economically more than anything, because when you hurt their money, that's when it seems to me they mostly hurt. But, it's always good to listen to people like yourself because you put forward good ideas. But, I don't know. I think I would probably be one that would pass on the political system. But, I enjoy listening to what you were saying.
But
good luck. Move forward.
But you've just laid out a good strategy. You said that, you know, at the very least, there needs to be some economic disruption. You need to, like, boycott and you need to withdraw support from it. And you also raised a point in saying that you don't agree with the political situation, because you said you can't just elect somebody and think that that's going to change anything. One of the problems is that all we do is elect people, but we don't hold them accountable once they're in office. So elections and getting engaged politically is not just around election time, but it runs the whole gamut of somebody being in office. And if they're not doing what you need done, then what you need to do is get them out.
But do you understand the psychology of our people in regards to those two things? Number one, you don't have the support of the so-called elected leaders to back a boycott. Number two, once you get a black person in office, it seems like he has no allegiance to black people anymore, and black people are so happy to have that black person in office that he just basically does whatever he chooses to. So, I mean, it's kind of crazy if you really think about it, because, you know, if you had these so-called leaders collectively said, I'll give you a perfect example. If all of these so-called pork chop chicken eating preachers that marched on Washington 2 weeks ago were to say, we're going to boycott, or I want my membership to boycott a certain place, and we all did it, then you would have some changes. But they would never do something like that. You know what I mean? But they will say indirectly, because they really don't want to mess with their money, oh, let's put Barack Obama in office. Let's support this new chick, Kamala Harris or Booker or some other Negro that basically is of no value towards the community, and we just settle and go along. And then when they do get in office, based on our being the ones that turn the tide, we let them get in and they do to us what Obama done. So, I mean, I don't know, man.
But again, you know, if you're talking about punishing through economics, which is a good strategy, you need to do the same thing politically. When Barack Obama was in the White House, members of the Congressional Black Caucus were saying, oh, gee, if there was anybody else in there, we would be demonstrating in front of the White House because of the high levels of black unemployment. But we've kind of like sat down on the job with Obama. Well, that's just what you did. You didn't hold up your end of it. So some of those people who didn't hold up their end of it should no longer be members of the black congressional Congress, because they should no longer be in Congress. Ferguson, perfect example. Well, a good example. What happened in Ferguson, and one of the many things that came out of it was that, okay, they came out with all this militarized, use of military equipment on peaceful protesters and all of that. Well, in the months before that outbreak, in the wake of the murder of what's the guy's name? Brown?
Michael Brown.
Mm-hmm. Michael Brown. There was an effort by a white Florida congressman to stop sending military equipment to local police departments. And the black congressman for that area that represents Ferguson did not support this white man's effort to stop the militarized policing. Yet in the wake of what happened in Ferguson, he pops up and says, oh, this is horrible. We shouldn't have this kind of weaponry on the streets. Negro, you're horrible, because you had an opportunity to do something and you didn't. And what happened? Folks put him right back in office. So part of this problem is us.
No, I would agree. Well, thank you, brother.
Thank you. I mean, I appreciate your reasoning, and you know, I understand your frustration. And please,
it's not
understand.
Frustration. You know what it is? You know what it is? It's not so much frustration. It's disappointment in the people that we over these last 50 years have placed in a position to lead us into a better position in this country for some reason seems to have done nothing honestly but to kowtow to white folks and try to get closer to Europeanism. You know what I mean? They don't want to deal in nothing African, nothing black. They just want to be at the daddy's house more than anything. And as you get older and you start to see your time on this earth is coming shorter and shorter, you get extremely frustrated, brother. So all you can do is just keep doing your work. But thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you again. And hopefully let somebody else call in and speak. Have a good day. Okay.
Thank you for your call, Jay.
If I can may say something, because I'm a must be obviously for all of us. I know we're eternal optimists, and you raised Professor Washington about the point of that this is a long distance race. So you know, and we talk about that as in generations, I guess. You know, so. And that the point is, you know, whether it's economic or political, it's the question about always rechecking our organizational strategy. Because what's going on is because, and I agree with what everyone said, is that our organizational effectiveness is what's been challenged. And the most effective, I mean, you raised earlier about, and others have raised too, with this Black Lives Matter, if you get considered a terrorist, now you ain't really just dealing with the FOP no more. And they in alignment with accepting, as you say. So, and we've had leadership from Malcolm to Martin or whatever, and Fred Hampton and others who at the local level have been organizing people. Kwame Ture, you know, when we go back that far, we have more present ones now. That when they are effective at the grass, recognizing we have to have an in and an out strategy. Those who will go into the system and those who will stay out. It's the ones that stay out that get taken away one way or another. We call them political prisoners. We call them, you know, those who've been killed, you know. And we have to look at that as, you know, as real, that's the reason why we're in a dilemma. Not that we hadn't done the right thing. It's that the state has said who in their way is going to be victors. And that has a long history. I think that we have to look at the successes not as relationship to what is happening right now, is that we are doing, but so as we do, others are doing too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's, you know.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Professor Washington, listen, I want to thank you for being with us. I know you went overtime. We were happy to have you here.
And we appreciate it.
Happy to have you here for the first time, and I hope it's not the last.
Okay, well, thank you. I appreciate it. And always good talking and good to hear from Richard.
I didn't want to. Thank you, sir.
I'll be reaching out to you in the future, sir.
Okay, great. You guys take care, and to your audience, I mean, this has been a great experience, and we need to, like, share this information and keep it going. So I commend, what you guys are doing, because it's very important. And just realize, if you only get one person per night, you've had 100% success.
I agree.
We try to look and say, you know, we got to get the whole multitude. Now, start with one and, you know, multiply on out.
I want to thank you for being with us.
All right, gentlemen. Take care. Peace.
Talk to you soon.
Peace. Thank you.
Right. Bye-bye.
We'll be right back.
Tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com. Not a Wu-Tang-a.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Hey, did y'all see the stuff I posted on my wall?
Nah, it didn't even show up in my news feed.
Man, I'm done with social media. All the injustice and brutality going around, and it's like they're trying to suppress our voice. We're trying to get the message out there, and you can't even share empowerment and what's going on around the country either.
Mm-mm. Nah, don't be dumb with social media, though. It's a tool, and there is a place where we have a voice. It's a Let's Buy Black 365 social network. You do anything you would on any other social network. Post pictures, videos, status updates, share resources and community news. But on Let's Buy Black 365, it's a platform for us and by us to tell our messages.
Whoa, that's like a digital underground railroad.
What's the name of that site again?
It's letsbuyblack365.com.
Yeah, I heard about that. It's all about networking, and you get points, right?
Yeah, the more you network, post, and share, the more points you get. Plus, you get points for posting pictures, sharing information, attending community events, and inviting others to network with you on the app.
Wow, that's all I need to know. I'm gonna go download that app right now.
Now, better yet, let me invite you so I can get some points. It's all about empowerment and solutions, y'all.
Yeah, that's what's up. I'm all in.
Let's do it. Let's share our stories.
Let's buy Black365.com.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
On the move. Assalamu alaikum. Free Momia. Free Momia. Free Momia. Free Momia now. Brothers and sisters, comrades, it's certainly my pleasure to be here. One of your state representatives from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, I am ashamed to be a state representative in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania with a chump like Governor Ridge at the helm. I'm ashamed. But I wanted to come here today to let you know that some of us are not afraid, that even though we may be elected, we'll say what's on our mind. But we must understand that we're freedom fighters first, and that all the other things come next. Then I'm a black man first, and then a state representative. I don't confuse the two. And I think it's time for us to wake up and realize and understand that you got a lot of us that are willing to go to battle, because the freedom ain't going to never be free unless we take it. There's too many of us sitting around thinking that it's going to come to us on some damn silver platter. Wake up, you fools, and understand this man has no respect for you. None. None whatsoever. And they will continue to do what they do to Mumia only because they feel that you don't have no heart. Well, let me just say this to y'all. I want to send a message to the FOP. I want to make it loud and clear so it won't be any mistake about what's being said today. And I'm saying it as a black man in the city of Philadelphia and not as the state representative. I ain't scared the hell of y'all. And I'm not going to let you intimidate our people either. That's over. So when you come on with some threat about you're going to boycott every event that we have and you're going to stop the people from coming to contribute their money, get the hell out of our way, because we ain't going nowhere. The time has come for everybody to wake up and realize that this ain't no joke. We're not going to let you take Mumia's life. And we want to send a message to America that the death penalty has got to end. we're going to wipe it out the same way they did in South Africa. But they did it by power of the people. When Nelson Mandela stepped out of jail and threw his hands up in the air, he was a strong brother. After 27 years being in jail, it didn't cripple his spirit. And I want to let all of you know that come from all across this country, you got some brothers and sisters in Philadelphia that are willing to rumble no matter what and ain't afraid of the Philadelphia police, the national police, the FOP, and all the rest of them that come together with it. In my conclusion, I just want to say, and I know the time has been rough today, but a lot of y'all need to know what this looks like for many of us here in the city of Philadelphia. Governor Ridge is getting a message again. Not only did those 115,000 calls go on, that's an underestimated of the number that have been calling, as an underestimated number of those who signed petitions, as an underestimated number of those who've come in and out of the city of Philadelphia from all across this country to give the kind of solidarity that's needed in order to make sure we free Mumia Abdul-Jabbar. We're not going to take this lying down. And I know that Mumia, in his heart, knows that we're all with him. So brothers and sisters, we're here as freedom fighters and black liberation strugglers who understand the importance of who and what we are, and we ain't gonna let no titles get in the way. Free Mumia. Free Mumia. Free Mumia. Free Mumia. No justice. No justice. Assalamu alaikum.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m. Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. I want to thank our guest that was with us this evening, Professor of Journalism at Temple University, Professor Lynn Washington, was with us this evening. Interesting conversation, Brother Richard. With Professor Washington,
definitely.
The first time he was on, and I know it won't be the last. But I really enjoyed his insight, especially you know, being that he has a law degree from Yale. His legal analysis of the situation, not only in Philadelphia, but nationally, dealing with the FOP, a lot of these court systems. It was a little different slant when we talk about these issues than what we had with some of the other guests, being a journalist and a lawyer at the same time. Interesting conversation, man. And that last conversation that he had with Brother Jay from New York, dealing with strategies moving forward, that's what I kind of always harp on. You know, at the end of the day of these conversations, look for ways where we can make plans to strategize, to use these cities, these temples, mosques, and churches as meeting points, just as our ancestors did in the past, to plan strategies and what we need to do to prepare our people to move forward instead of always reacting to a lot of these racist incidents. We know the type of country we live in. We know the people we're dealing with. You don't expect anything less. What we have to do is prepare our children to move forward. Jay mentioned that, you know, he's getting older, and he's right. None of us are getting any younger. But we have to come up with ways where we can prepare our children to move forward out of the situation that they're in, instead of being on a treadmill where we keep reacting to the same situations that happened 50 years ago, 25 years ago, 100 years ago. It's like we were like that movie Groundhog Day, where you keep on reliving the same situation over and over again. It has to stop. And, you know, he mentioned about some of these elected officials giving a tacit response and releasing press releases after the community was upset about the non-response. You know, come on, they can take that press release and stick it where the sun don't shine. They need some real, speak with a voice. You just heard the recording of late Brother Dave Richardson, who was a state representative here in Philadelphia. That's the type of responses you need. Mean what you say and say what you mean. That's why I played that recording of your representative, not representative, the
attorney general,
the attorney general down there in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing that I appreciate with what she said, Richard, was this. She said that she wasn't going to prosecute those guys or go after them again after it was thrown out. But she gave the community an explanation why.
Why?
And
right.
Clear explanation that it was racism that tied her hands. She didn't sugarcoat it, give some type of old bull crap response. She let the community know clearly what she was dealing with and what they're dealing with.
Mm-hmm. That's so powerful and important.
Exactly. Ellie. Yeah, because, listen, we know that a lot of these people, black folks, some of them that might have the community in their heart can get in these offices and their hands be tied. But what they can do is become a whistleblower. Pull the cover off these people. Say what's going on. Say the reason why things can't be done. Say this guy's a bigot and a racist when you don't see him out there in the TV cameras, that behind the scenes he's saying all kind of stuff, because they see it. They see it in those halls of whether it's the state hall, the federal hall. They see these white folks and what they're doing. They don't come back and tell the community nothing.
And Professor Washington gives an example of what even in they little clubs. I mean, you know it, but you can't. That they're here, they'll go drinking and that's, let's say that is a generation ago, but they're probably still going on now. They go drinking and bringing their wives, and they just slap them around and slap their wives around, and you don't hear nothing.
To the point where one of the callers, Scotty or one of them, said that they just couldn't believe it. But believe it, it's true.
Mm-hmm.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. And for Philadelphia, I mean, don't get me started, Elliot, you know, because when you look over our history, and I hope that the listening audience look over the history of the area that they're in, not the short history of, as you say, episode to episode, but look over the long history and see why the people, and whether they be the ministers, the civic organizations, the political representatives, how that culture has evolved over time. And you'll see why the condition that we have is the way it is. And then also look for those people who have responded against that and see where they are. You know, it's imperative that we look at our political history in order to understand, because in our political history, it gets into what decisions do we make utilizing the strategic tools that aren't meant to work for us, but how we can be creative and make it work for us in our organizing effort. But we have to be clear that political history and looking in our particular areas that we're in. And you'll see the same thing, that the reason why, you'll see why these black, as you say, the ministers and the politicians are able to do, the police chiefs are able to maintain our condition in the way it is, instead of being vocal voices of what is actually going on that produces the condition that we're in. They won't do it.
You know, we one thing I wanted to mention when Professor Washington was on, that the Guardian Civic League here in Philadelphia, which is the black officers' wing of that represents black officers, the Guardian Civic League, and also the NAACP, the Guardian Civic League president, Rochelle Bilal, and the NAACP president, Brother Rodney Muhammad, is standing behind the suit that's filed against white superiors of, I think it's six narcotics officers, filed suit against their white superiors for racism and corruption. So, you know, it's necessary, Richard, that the community supports what they're doing, supports their efforts, you know, I might have had some opinions about both of the organizations before, you know, they stood up here because, you know, to me, I think they were silent on too many issues or a lot of issues that had went by the boards. But you have to give credit where credit is due. When they stood up and are backing these officers, these black officers, they're going to need backing. They're coming against some of these the systems that's going on here and the supporters of this white supremacy. Let's grab this call. 267-267 air code.
Hey, Elliot. Hey, Richard. This is Ralph. How you doing?
Hey, Ralph.
All right. How you doing, man?
All right. And, hey, Elliot, I told you about how I try to contact, you know, Sherelle Parker, put on his big show on, the morning show on the local station. And I said, like, okay, I got some issues. Let me call. And lady said, well, she's in a meeting right now. Give me your name and number, and I'll make sure that somebody will call you back. Well, nobody called me back. But the thing about it, what did they do with my information and my phone number? Did they take that to the plantation and give it to Master? You know what I mean? Because we got to start thinking these things, man. These people are not there to represent us. I've been telling people this for 10, maybe, no, man, it's been longer than that. It's probably back in the 90s I've been telling them about these elected officials. You know, they are not here to represent us. And a matter of fact, they sort of make us look stupid because anytime we reelect that woman that was driving drunk down a one-way street, you know, something's wrong with us. You know, something's wrong with us. I've been telling people about Ron Waters. I've been telling people about the other clown from Yaden, Pennsylvania, Hardy Williams' son. You know, now we got these other frauds up in there. When are we, like Lynn Washington was right, when are we going to stop the madness? You know, I have listened to that the morning host on the local station. He used to hang up the phone on me, but now he's repeating the same things that I used to say to him when he used to hang the phone up on me. So when are we going to stop the madness? You know what I mean? And that's the major question we have to ask. These people don't represent us. Matter of fact, they should get one term. If they don't do what they're supposed to do in one term, get them out of there. But no, yeah. All they got to do is throw a block party and bring some local bands there, give us some chicken dinners at a local church, and we think they're being kind to us. Man, these people have been playing us for like the last, since I became aware, it might have been even longer than that, you know. But since I became aware, over 20 years. So you know.
And you know what, Ralph, to be honest, and I agree with Jay when Jay said that, I think he said he's not angry, that he was just disillusioned, disappointed. Because, you know, listen, if you look at a historical perspective, white folks by and large think that black people are stupid and less intelligent. They do. But the thing that's really, that really pulls at your heart and gets you despondent is that some of these black elected officials, they get in these offices and they take the same attitude towards you that white folks do. They look at your people like they look at their own brothers like they stupid, that they can take advantage of them. Like you just said, they don't do anything, but then soon as election time get ready to come around, here comes the block parties, the hot dogs and hamburgers, and bring a couple bands in. And the next thing you know, when it's time to get elected, their name is splashed around and people vote for them again. But
well,
nothing
seems to be.
Go ahead. I'm
here's
sorry.
A harsh question. Here's a harsh question. What does that tell you about the people that vote them back in office?
Yeah.
And that's a harsh question, but you got to think about it. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm still listening to folks talk about how great Barack Obama was. So maybe these people got a point.
Or Frank Rizzo.
Cried at his funeral. Mm. I seen him on TV crying at his funeral. So, you know,
at the same time, Ralph, we have to say that while those who are and looking at them, and that's why I look at them, but I don't think we should count them. The people who do vote for them, I don't think we should count them. We should be looking at the people who don't vote
or I mean, and as Jay said, it's not about the vote for me. It's about the people that are the potential people we can organize, the people that are the potential people that will become conscious and strategize and be, and do the kind of thinking and then assist in the organizing. That's what we, because the number of people who are dropping out of political, using that as the matrix, is higher than even the people who are participating.
Right.
That, I mean, you know, every year.
But I'm going to say something about that, Richard. The people who aren't voting,
right.
I might have to agree that they're the smart ones.
That's what I'm saying.
What are we voting for? Last time we had Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. What would you do that? What, you know, I voted for Mickey Mouse. I went there and I wrote Mickey Mouse in.
Good stop.
Well, the morning host tells us that we have to vote. That's our right. So, you know, I mean, on one hand, this person wants to kill me. On the other hand, this person wants to kill me. So why am I being stupid and vote for either one of them?
I agree.
You know what I mean? Sometimes, Mickey Mouse, he won't organize a mob to kill me or bring in people to replace me and have my people all unemployed and this, that, and the other and removing the public school system all over this country. Because if you look at where it's happening, all Democratic mayors, they tell you all politics is local. I mean, they tell you right to your face. All politics is local. You got Rahm Emanuel out there in Chicago. He was Barack Obama's advisor. Yet look what he's doing out there in Chicago. These people are telling you who they are. And it seems like we're too blind to see it. Like I said, I still go back to that movie, The Planet of the Apes, the last one. You had the people coming from the north, they hated the apes. And you had the neo-Nazis, they hated the apes. Who are we going to vote for out of their league? Come on, man. So, you know, sometimes I look at the people who don't vote as the intelligent ones.
I agree. And Elliot, if I may add just this other point, because I think it's important when we look at especially the elected officials, you effectively deal with the ministers in relationship to the things they use. But we know once they get elected, you know, they have to make an oath. They don't make an oath to their people. They make an oath to the state. Every one of them. Everybody who touches that system has to take an oath to the state. So as soon as they take the oath to the state, that's who they represent. Now, the people who put them in might think they would put them in to represent them, but once they take that oath, they are officials of the state. And that's even school teachers and principals and administrators. So we have to be clear that the black people, when they take these positions, unless they are, you know, people use the spook to set beside the door, unless the oath that they take is to the same system that historically has been about not allowing Africans to have full identity as human beings or as political systems, political citizens. So, and they get paid for that. And they say they get paid good.
Well, you know, I mean, so did the House Negroes. So, you know, I mean, same thing. And, you know, and the thing about it, I love what Barack Obama did for 8 years. He actually woke people up to realize even if you have a black man in the highest office in the land, it don't mean a daggone thing. So, you know, I mean, but he still didn't wake us up. We're still asleep. I still hear people calling radio stations talking about Hillary won the election and how great Barack was. And we need him and his wife back in the White House again. And I'm saying, for what? You know what I mean? And this DACA thing. I mean, I'm starting to hear us beat the drums about DACA now. But, you know, the thing about it, man, and you know, I know Jay can relate to this because he come from New York. Even the Africans that look like us don't have nothing to do with us up there in New York. Matter of fact, they think they supposed to discriminate against us up there in New York City. So, you know, I mean, you know, we got to recognize what's up. Sometimes I agree with that brother Alan. I agree with him because we better start recognizing our fight and leave all these other folks alone. They don't want to have no coalition with you. And I don't even call myself African because I see what comes off that continent. So, you know, I don't even call myself that. So, you know, I'm just going to stick to my beliefs. I'm seeing what I see, and that's about it, man, because I see what comes off that continent. They're in worse shape than we are mentally. So, you know, we got to find a solution. We got to find it fast or we'll be extinct before you know it. That's why sometimes I do agree with Brother X. You know, it'd be one day, maybe in the near future, little boy look and say, what's that? And they said, that was a Negro. He voted for people who didn't care for them. They loved the president that actually didn't care for them. And they're extinct because they just couldn't find a solution on how to get out of their dilemma. We got to come up with a solution, and we got to come up with it fast. So, you know, I just had to call in, man, because I am on the same wavelength as Jay. You know, this stuff gets quite depressing looking at it, especially politics and religion. And I did send you that email, Elliot, about David Carroll and what he said about Joel Osteen. But if you really listen to what he – and what you really – if you listen to him, he wasn't really attacking Joel Osteen. He was attacking those of us who follow him. So – you know, I mean, so, you know, it's a whole bunch of stuff we have to, like, really wake up on. Like you said, time for awakening, but, man, what, the program been on 10 years and we still snoring? We got to wake up, bro. So that's all I had, man. I just had to call in. I listened to the whole program, but I just had to call in because it does strike a nerve with me every time I hear the way we keep on participating in our own demise. And you got leaders and people with voices tell us to keep participating in our own democracy. That's why I say the people that are actually intelligent. I have some friends. I say, did you vote? Did you vote for Obama? For what? Why? I say, like, you. Oh, all right. Well, I'm not going to argue with you. You know what I mean? Because that's a good question. So. I gotta leave off with that, fellas. But have a good night. It was a good program. Good guest. And I'll be talking to y'all.
Thank you for your call, brother.
Take care, brother.
All right, now. All right.
Elliot.
Go ahead, Richard.
Hey, can I? It's something as I hear our voices, and I just wanted to reemphasize a point. I guess you know for me.
Go ahead.
It's something out of Hosea, which is the African. You know, the text that comes out of Kemet, ancient Egypt, you know, that Marilana Karanga, when he did translation, it's in the Middle Kingdom. So that's like around 1800 BC, one of the writings is dealing with the Suruj, which is about reparation, you know, advancing the cause of reparations. And one of the persons, the ethical writings, they said, or the way he translates it, it comes out to this: to raise up that which is in ruin, to repair that which is damaged, to rejoin that which is severed, to replenish that which is depleted, to strengthen that which is weakened, to set right that which is wrong, and to make flourish that which is insecure and underdeveloped. And, you know, when I read these things that of our moral code and our vision that they pass on to us, it seems to fit for our time. And this is now what? That's 1800 BC. This is 2000, close to 4,000 years ago. And to me, that's the motivation that we
have those who come out of the history of the continent of Africa or the African historical lineage to be able to look back, take the long view back, and then do as you say, think of using those voices told us, coming up with strategies and goals for the moments that we live in. Because it's nothing new, and it ain't like we haven't done it before, and we can and we will do it again to make great what we have demonstrated we have made great before. So it may be personal, but I think a lot out in the listening audience and for those who, you know, the callers who do get to call in, it should be encouraging that we can and we will do. And if we continue to look at our history, it will show us how and why, if not what, to do. So I just thought that was something I wanted to share at this moment.
I agree, Richard. We do have those blueprints there from our ancestors on how we can get out of these situations that we're in. And, you know, when you read some of those things in the writings, you get the impression, Richard, that in their vast wisdom, because you see it was vast wisdom around at that time, mm-hmm. that they knew that things might get a little rocky for us in the future millennia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they left breadcrumbs for us to get out of these situations. I don't think from the writings that they left and from the little bit I understand, you could see clearly that they knew that things wasn't going to always be like they were.
Right.
Now, I'll give an example. The man we're dealing with and the man that's been on top for the past 500 years, in his mind, he thinks he's going to always be up top.
Mm-hmm.
That's his limited. He doesn't have that third spiritual eye to look at things in perspective. He doesn't. It's clear he doesn't. But our ancestors did. You could see from their writings that they knew that we'd hit some rocky roads. But it's ways for us to come out of this. Now, the only thing this man knows, he knows there's some clues there. He knows clearly there's clues there. So he has a concerted effort over the hundreds of years to keep our people ignorant. That's been his ace in the hole, to keep our people ignorant. And divide and conquer, divisiveness. Ralph mentioned about Africans from the continent. They all get the same spiel, whether it's Africans from the continent or some from the Caribbean. They get the same spiel from this man. Don't deal with the African Americans when you come up here. Stay away from them. They're a problem. And some of them, they buy into it because of ignorance. They listen to this man that tells them these narratives. And then when they get here, they're treated the same way as the individuals that he told them to stay away from. So who's laughing in the end? He is. He wins. We both turn out to be losers.
Yes, sir.
The only salvation is us to find strategies to work, to come together and work together to alleviate ourselves of a common problem. Because I don't care whether you're talking about it on the continent, in the diaspora of the islands, South America, here, that we got a common problem.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what it is? I'll let the listening audience guess. You get three guesses. Oh, boy. You know, next week we're scheduled to have one of the foremost activists here in the city of Philadelphia that's been pushing for justice with David Jones. I won't give any names yet because I'll wait till I confirm it. I know I did talk with him, and he's been getting a lot of death threats, and he needed some time to kind of decompress. And I respect that. So once we get confirmation, I'll put the information out, and hopefully he'll be here next Sunday to let our people know what's been going on here in Philadelphia and what will happen in other cities where some of these people stand up and put their safety and their welfare on the line. We didn't see that. That's an historical perspective that we didn't see through history.
Right.
Of black people standing up and putting their life and limb and welfare on the line for the community. We can't just allow that anymore and just sit back and look like we're watching a tennis match and watch the person either sink or swim. We got to do some kind of ways to aid our brothers and sisters, whether it's getting out there with them, providing them a platform and a voice. It's something that we can do. It's something that all of us can do. We just got to figure out what our contribution is and do it. And, you know, Ralph mentioned about some of our people. Listen, I'm the eternal optimist when it comes to our people. Our people just don't have, a lot of them don't have the information, or they buy into other forms of information. Like every day listening to Steve Harvey and Tom Joyner with laughing and joking and Amos and Andy satires all day. And then talking about it the rest of the day. And can't wait for the next day to turn it on again. If that's the case, Rich, you ain't going to never know what's going on. You'll never know what's happening politically with some of these charlatan black politicians in these cities or the things that Obama did or didn't do. You'll never know it because they're not going to talk about it on the shows that some of our people be listening to and have a steady diet of. I could see if that crap comes on once a week. But that stuff is on every day. And some form of it, you hear it almost half of the day. Come on here. Come on. Richard, listen, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Well, the struggle continues. And listen, I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Again, there's going to be a lot of different programs that you're going to hear in the coming weeks. On Time for Awakening, a lot of conscious programming, a lot of programming that's going to be geared towards solutions. So I'm anxious to see them. Some of the folks you've heard from that have been previewed, letting you know the programs that's coming down the pike, you're going to hear some of the other hosts coming on at later times talking about their programs, and then you just might hear the programs coming on. But either way, you're going to hear them being billboarded. Time for Awakening is trying to expand its reach, and you're right here with us to help us do it. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
You're watching your children playing after school. They seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of the thing that they'll soon be right at the heart of. My little Tommy, he said he wants to be a fireman. And little Mary, she said she got to teach school.
got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. To save the children.